My name is Susan Berkelow, and I am a Lutheran pastor who for 5 years worked in Chile with the Lutheran Church. And since that time, I've been working in Los Angeles and have recently moved to New York, and have also spent some amount of time traveling in Latin America, in Central America and other places. Most recently, in February, mid-February through the end of April, I went to Mexico City for a conference. And after that, did some traveling through Guatemala and El Salvador and Nicaragua and Panama, and sort of tried to update myself on what was happening. And because you feel like you get out of touch, just the newspapers don't quite do it. And other reports are helpful, but you find you want to have some other context sometimes to see what is happening. So I have been recently doing a lot of exploring on my own around the issues in Latin America. I also coordinate the Lutheran Coalition on Latin America called LUCOLA, which is a grassroots group of people who have some concerns about Latin America and the issues that are around that for us as Lutherans, and are concerned about our response as Lutherans in this country to those situations and those issues. So my concerns extend over a wide variety of places and people. And I always look forward to an opportunity to share with others who have some of those concerns also. The other day I was asking how many people spoke Spanish in the group that had gathered this week. Talked about El Salvador. Anybody here speak Spanish? One. A few words, yes. As we get down to from the qualifications, from fluency down to how many could survive for a day speaking Spanish. How many of you have traveled to Latin America? Has anybody been in Latin America? Where were you? Did you go with the Augsburg College program? Okay. Anybody else travel? Oh, really? Oh, fewer people have been to Haiti than to Central America. But, and did you go with the program then?
No. Well, I guess you could say.
Okay. Really? Oh, well, maybe we'll have a chance to have some sharing about that, too. I think it certainly has changed my life, the time I've spent in Latin America. I came back from Chile to go to seminary, and I always had the impression that I'd really been to seminary already when I was there, and it sort of gave me a different perspective as I went through my education, because I brought with me questions and issues that were of concern. Joe's been to Latin America also. My husband, Joe Barnett, was also on this trip, so I anticipate that if I make any grave errors in my reporting, He may pick them up. Right, we are. In that sense, we are, yes. And, yeah, we share concerns for the same parts of the world and try to travel together also when we can. But it was a good trip, and there's some exciting things happening now in Central America and some important things, I think, for us as Christians to be concerned about. So I just wanted to share a little bit of that with you today, and we can do this pretty informally, I think, and looks like everybody will have a chance to speak, which wasn't always true in the other session. I brought a map just in case we weren't sure what we were talking about here. I couldn't find my map of just El Salvador. This is a Central America map. Does everybody know where El Salvador is? This map is not very good because the colors are all pretty similar. This is Guatemala. The yellow is Guatemala. This is Belize, this pink up here, which I never knew existed until a couple of years ago. Very little. And, yes. Yes. Pardon? Went to Belize? Oh. Oh, interesting. Well, it's on the map. People go there. Down here we have Honduras. Honduras is a little bit larger. And down in here, between Guatemala and Honduras, is El Salvador. This little space down here. And here we have Nicaragua, that is just down over here, and then down to Costa Rica and Panama. So, compared to El Salvador, it is, yes. It covers a lot of space, but in terms of inhabitants, when you look at Latin American populations, you find in Guatemala, too, people tend to live in a cluster in a smaller area because a lot of the land is jungle in Guatemala and doesn't have a lot of population. El Salvador is the smallest country in Central America. It's about the size of Massachusetts, and it has about 6 million people living in this. It's also the most densely populated. So when you look at this little tiny space here, you're looking at wall-to-wall people, border-to-border people in a very small space. It was hard for me to grasp that while I was there because I had this big map of El Salvador about like this, and I kept thinking, well, we fit the United States on a page like this too, and I kept thinking El Salvador must be bigger than it really was, but you can drive through it very quickly. But anyway, that's the place we're focusing on. And I just wanted to check with you. I don't want to tell you anything you already know, but I thought we would collect our knowledge here and find out what is it we do know about El Salvador. Does anybody want to offer any information you have? I already shared with you the size of the country. What else do we know about El Salvador? When somebody says El Salvador to you, what do you think of? Clements, Witness to War. Witness to War. Has anybody heard of that book? Anybody else heard of that book or read it? Charlie Clements is a doctor. He was formerly an Air Force pilot who left the military, became a doctor, became a Quaker, pacifist, and decided to go to El Salvador, and he volunteered his time for, I think, a little over a year in accompanying the civilian populations in the war and ministering to them as a doctor. And the book Witness to War then is his sharing of his experience in El Salvador during that time, what he learned from that particular experience with the people. I have with me also the video of Witness to War. Has anybody seen that? That's a videotape that we're having a staff meeting in a little while, and we're hoping we'll have some video hours set up this coming week because there are a number of things that would take too long in one session to see always, but we were seeing because he tells his experience after having been in Vietnam and then going to El Salvador, the things that were triggered in his experience. So you must know something about the war in El Salvador. Okay, that's a pretty important fact. Yes, it is. It's been had a number of military dictatorships, and it's still dominated. The government is still dominated by the military. And also, they're a small elite of people that have most of the resources in that country. The government in El Salvador is basically made up of a president, and they do have a legislative assembly. And then they have the military. You can't ever exclude the military as just a branch of government. The military is always more than that in Latin America. It's very autonomous in a lot of ways in El Salvador. It's probably since early 1930s that they've had military generals as their leaders, and there have been a number of coups that have gone on during that time. They talk about the military as basically supporting 14 families that rule the country. Their current president, anybody know the name of their president currently? Come to your mind? Yeah, Duarte. Jose Napoleon Duarte is quite a name. But he's been around for a while as a member of the Christian Democrat Party and was elected in 84, he was elected president. There have been a couple of things that have happened in that government. They do have a new constitution since 1983, but since 1980 they've been in a state of siege. They've been at war. So whatever they have in the constitution isn't under civil rights, isn't really valid right now. So you could say they have a constitutional government, but right now it's superseded by the fact that they're at war and the military seems to be the strongest hold over the country at this time. And they have many different parties as well. Anything else you know about the situation, the government, or the history, or
Catholic Church?
Archbishop Romero was very well known in El Salvador. Some people have more representation than others, and that's really questionable. The elections that they had in 1984 were supposed to have been relatively fair, but it's also very clear then, if you look at it, that any party to the left of the Christian Democrats was excluded, which is a large part of the population as well. So in that sense, there's not a fair representation in that. Some people do have some representation. I think you picked out some of the key things about El Salvador. It was colonized by Spain in the early, in 1500s, was independent as of 1821. But in the 1880s, it began to be taken over by a few families who consolidated their power over the big coffee industry that was developed this plantation economy. And Bishop Medardo Gomez of the Lutheran Church there tells about his earliest ancestors, the Indian peoples of El Salvador, and says they were very egalitarian. They had a lot of common property. Private property was not part of their culture. But around the 19th century, the Spaniards certainly knew something about private property. They tried to take El Salvador as their private property. But these families tended to take over then the end of the 19th century and have continued to do so ever since then. Their independence then was very much limited by power being controlled by these people. And the military dictatorships did a lot to consolidate their power. The people sort of developed a police force of their own to protect their holdings, and it developed into a very strong, powerful military. But the people of El Salvador also had very strong leaders. Has anybody heard of Farabundo Martí? Does that name ring any bells? Very famous folk hero of El Salvador, who led an uprising in 1932 against the repressive general of the time. And he himself was executed, became a great hero for the people. And at the same time, however, 30,000 peasants were also assassinated by the General Martinez at the time in sort of reprisals for this uprising of people demanding better working conditions and just wages, which was at that time 2% of the population. And as we look at our own history, there are probably certain things that stand out and we recognize as our own identity that help remind us who we are. But the people in El Salvador remember that incident as a very important symbol of the repression that they've continued to experience from military governments. And the name Martí has become very important and now has been attached also to the main military opposition to the government, or the armed opposition to the government and to the military. They call it the Farabundo Martí National Liberation Front. And it's a consolidated group of five different guerrilla groups that are now protesting against the military. After 50 years of rule, they've consolidated in this particular way. It's not totally unconnected to the economy. I mentioned coffee as a main export product of El Salvador, also sugar cane and cotton and cattle. But one-third of their farmable land is going into export crops, and that makes a big difference as to what they have left for themselves. It's also true that 2% of the people in El Salvador control 50% of the land. That also determines who's making the money off the export crops and who is able to eat off of them. About 60% of El Salvador's workforce is agriculturally involved, but it's a seasonal, as we know here too, a seasonal sort of work, which means that a great percentage of them, some estimate up to 3/5, are either unemployed or underemployed. And in a dense country like this, you can imagine the sort of stresses that causes in the population. They have attempted some land reform. Duarte also has made a lot of promises in that area. But actually, the most significant part of the land reform that could have had a big effect has not been done, and that's the expropriating of the coffee land, and that's just never been done. So pretty much the situation continues as it has for a long time. There's some industry of food and clothing, and almost all of that is for export to developed countries, such as us into Europe. And what El Salvador provides then is a cheap labor source for articles that we often receive here too. Prices have been going up, wages have been frozen in the last few years, since 1980 at least. People have tried striking more often, but also there's a lot more repression on strikes. They've been put down quite a bit. Socially, about 50% of the country is illiterate. And in the countryside, that's even greater. It's more like 90% of the people who live in the country are illiterate, but over the whole country. The infant mortality is about 10%, which, anybody know what it is in this country? No, that's very much too high.
Right.
Less than that. I'd heard it was, yes, I'd heard it was about 1.4% in our country now. It's like 14 out of every 1,000. But in El Salvador, it's 100 out of every 1,000. And I don't really think that includes war statistics. I think we're talking the normal way of judging infant mortality in a country. And they estimate that 3/4 of all children, 75% of all children under age 5 are malnourished. And as came out probably in the Witness to War book, medical health services are very limited with perhaps no more than one doctor per 1,000 people. So, you know, you sort of get a picture of an economy that is being very stressed out pretty much on all level of a society's normal way of functioning. The war has been in effect since 1979 when one of the generals was overthrown. And they had like 3 civilian governments, all died out. The military just couldn't handle a civilian leader and pretty much undid that. And so about 1980, 7 years ago, the opposition, both political and military, started to consolidate itself and formed a Democratic Revolutionary Front, which is the FDR. It's just as difficult in politics in Latin America almost as in the Lutheran Church, trying to figure out all these letters. I never remember exactly which they are. But the military or the armed part of this front of opposition to the government is called the FMLN, which I said was the Farabundo Martí National Liberation Front. And this is the main group now that is opposing the government and leading what resistance there is against it. One of the things that makes the war there as devastating and as volatile as it is that the United States has taken El Salvador, this little country of El Salvador, and made it a real point of a line where it says, this is where we're going to stop the communist insurgency, which is how the U.S. has viewed the situation in El Salvador. And so it's become a point of focus for the United States in not wanting the government to be changed. And so that has helped focus on this. The toll that this 7-year war has taken is estimated about 60,000 civilian deaths, 6,000 disappeared people, 500 imprisoned political prisoners, and about 500,000 displaced people within the country. Sort of, I still have a hard time imagining how they've displaced in this country, which is already so small, but you can imagine if people are moved from one place to another within the same country, it's just going to aggravate all the conditions that were already there. And about 750,000 people have been displaced abroad in Mexico or Honduras or the United States or other countries. So when you think of the 6 million people, it represents a large number of the population, close to 30%, I think, that are just displaced alone. And I think, as I envision it, I can't think of a single family that would not have somebody who was affected by this whole situation, and either by death, displacement, or any combination of those, imprisonment. Anybody know about United States aid to El Salvador? I can't remember the exact dollar amount right now. I'm trying to remember. But in terms of countries receiving the most U.S. aid, military aid, do you know what they are, or what number El Salvador is? How high it is on the list of recipients? Can you imagine half of the national budget that we are paying? We have this tremendous debt, and we're supporting half of El Salvador's budget. Right. I think it's about $1 million a day. But El Salvador is number 3 in terms of U.S. aid. First is Israel and Egypt, and then El Salvador. I mean, this little tiny country is, you know, just the recipient of a tremendous amount of money, most of which is going into military aid. And most of the money ends up with those people who are opposing the reforms that Duarte has promised but has so far been unable to produce, partly because the military has been autonomous. And the bombings have become more frequent, and the situation of the war right now is that most people say it can't be won again. In maybe 3 to 5 years something might happen, but basically it's seen as an unwinnable war without decimating the population even more. Somebody mentioned the church. You mentioned the Catholic Church being involved in the situation. I don't know. Do you know about the Lutheran Church in El Salvador? Has anybody had any contact with Lutherans? Yeah, it's true. The whole situation of the church has changed a lot over the years. throughout the centuries, there have been sort of three major powers in the church, I mean, in Latin America, forces or powers that have controlled what's happened in society. And one way that this has often been described is sort of, if you look at this, this is not a Salvadoran volcano, this is society in Latin America. But if you look at this particular way of seeing the people of a society, I told you something about what it was like in El Salvador, and it's true for many of the Latin American countries. What percentage, or if we were going to draw a line here, this is a great bulk of people, where would be the line for the wealthiest people? How far down do you think that would go? Okay, so it would be probably about here.
Put it up here.
Okay. Well, you have to have something we can see there's a line, so we have to do that. But okay, so a very small percentage of the people would be in the upper echelons of society with the control, with power, with resources to do something. How about middle class? I haven't said anything about middle class here. What's your perception in Latin America or in El Salvador about a middle class? Small? About how small? Where would you put them? Here?
How do you put it?
Higher? About here? Yeah. Okay. There we go. And then we have this group right here. Is that how you would envision American society at all? Or how would you see American society different from that?
Where would class is the biggest class in America.
Okay, where would you put this line in the U.S.? I have no statistics to prove you right or wrong, so go ahead and guess. Where would you put the... right about here, about the same as that one? And how about for the middle, bottom of the middle class line, where would you put that? Here? Farther down?
Back down? No, I think the poverty is growing.
It's growing. Even as we speak, it is growing.
So I put it up a little higher.
Okay, right about here?
A little bit. Yeah.
Right about there? Okay, this is a very scientific thing.
25%?
Okay, I knew somebody did.
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, that's about right then. Okay, there's a major difference here, which makes it harder for us sometimes to grasp why things are happening there. And I think it's important for us to know this, even as our government says that we're having a war down there because there are communists trying to take over. I think it's important to know that up here in this particular privileged class, there have traditionally, historically, been three groups of people that have been a part of that. One has been the military, even though the military has often come from other ranks, but often, more traditionally, it's come from the upper class. The military, the government has been run by that, and also the church. We've had a history of siding with the wealthy. Really been almost in a sense chaplains to the wealthy part of the population. But that's been changing, and this is shifting now. Oh, I should say also, this part right here is traditionally is what is known in Latin America as el pueblo. When we say the people in the United States, you know, I think we usually think sort of of everybody, but predominantly perhaps of the common people, which we think of as more in the middle class area. But for Latin Americans, el pueblo is a great percentage of the people who, for the most part, have historically been disenfranchised.
For the landowners, the military and government.
Right, they do all those things, usually. If they have several children, one would often go to the church, become a priest, one would go to the military, and others would have the education to go into government or other privileged positions in society. But when the more repressive they've been, and there's been a lot of oppression that's been supported by each other, the more pressure that's been placed on the people, the pueblo, and things have been happening in this whole section that have really caused the top to blow off of this a little bit. And the church has been a part of it. So when you say the church has had significant effect, the church has really moved down into here in some new ways since Vatican II, when the church made a commitment to be with the poor, to be in solidarity with the poor. And that meant working with the poor, it meant living with the poor, it meant everything that had previously also just been ignored. And the conferences of bishops in Medellin in Colombia also reaffirmed that a few years later in 68. They also made that commitment. And as the priests began working with the people began reading the Bible. They gained a whole new understanding of themselves as God's children and respect and dignity of their lives. And it started to contradict what was happening in their reality. And people got upset, and the priests were upset with them and began protesting. And a lot of the things that are happening in Latin America now come out of that whole sense of frustration that's been built up over decades and centuries. And also, it cannot be ignored that a major, major part of that fermenting comes from, I would say, the living word of God just sort of acting as leaven within the community of the people. And they're speaking out with the courage that I think comes from that kind of a commitment. So that's part of what's going on in El Salvador as well. In 1976, Archbishop Oscar Arnulfo, Arnulfo Romero became Archbishop. And he himself, in the process of his ministry, began to take very courageous stands with the poor. He saw that he seemed to be a very good pastor. He didn't have a lot of the conviction, apparently, when he first became Archbishop. But as he began to share more with his people, he began to feel their plight as his own, and became an incredible spokesperson for those who were poor, those who were oppressed, and those who were disenfranchised. And what often happens, you know what happens though when the church does this, it always happens this way, is that the oppression also comes then on the church. And just a year after he became Archbishop, one of the first martyrs of the Roman Catholic Church, Father Rutilio Grande, was killed. And that began a series of oppressive events within the Roman Catholic Church, that number of priests had disappeared or were killed, and it became a very dangerous thing to be working for the church. A lot of lay people had been trained in teaching, and that was a very dangerous thing, because those in power began to realize that where church people went, the people they were with were no longer satisfied with things the way they are. And so that continued until March 24th in 1980, when Archbishop Romero was assassinated while he was celebrating the Mass in a church at a hospital in San Salvador. And the most powerful spokesperson for the poor in El Salvador was made into an instant martyr, and suddenly became just as powerful a force in a very interesting way in the people, almost as he had been before. Every year, you may have noticed this in your own communities, I don't know. How many of you celebrate Central America Week in your communities? Have you noticed any celebrations? Does Holton celebrate Central America Week? Good. I thought they would. But the commemoration has been centered around the anniversary of his death. And in San Salvador, we were there in March of this year. They had, for instance, on the 24th, a number of masses, one at the hospital where he was killed. But also they have a large march during the day in which people march through the streets of San Salvador singing hymns and speaking his words, saying down with oppression and just affirming the ministry that he had had among them and themselves. Also, later that year in 1980, four American churchwomen were killed. You probably remember that also in El Salvador near the airport. And that was also an event which really drew the religious communities together, ecumenically, not just among Roman Catholics. It's very much a shared experience. But that was pretty much a lot of Roman Catholic history, and you may wonder where the Lutherans fit into this. The Lutheran Church has been in El Salvador since the early 1950s. At this moment, there are about 6,000 members. There are about 15 pastors, including since last September. And last August, there was only two pastors, one of whom became bishop, and there were 13 lay deacons. And those throughout the year, in two different times, those deacons were ordained and became pastors, two of whom are women, which is a first for the Salvadoran Lutheran Church, which is first for, I think, almost any Lutheran church in Latin America, in Central America, not Latin America. And the church has experienced a lot of the same oppression because they too have shared that same ministry. They started in, well, a long time ago, they were involved in social work within the country, but in 1972, they also established an organization called Socorro Luterano Salvadoreño, a sort of Lutheran, Salvadorian Lutheran aid, or something, translates like that. But it's aid, all kinds of aid for people, including medical, including psychological, and other forms of emergencies that are now very prevalent in society. In 1982, the displaced people of these, however many, I said there were 500,000, began also to be a concern to the Lutheran Church, and they set up a refugee camp, which was called Fe y Esperanza, Hope, Faith and Hope, Lutheran community, which is just outside of San Salvador. And they started with like 250 people and had anywhere between 400 and 700 during the time that camp was at its height in terms of numbers. A number of other things began to happen, though, also. In 1983, the president of the church, Medardo Gomez, and the head of Socorro Luterano Salvadoreño were picked up by the military. They were interrogated. They were beaten. They were held in custody for a certain period of time, and then they were released. In 1984, one other Lutheran pastor, David Fernandez, was disappeared, and his mutilated body was found shortly thereafterwards. And it's taken till just a month ago, I think, for the people who did, who committed that murder to be tried. Every time they tried to get a jury together, the jurors would disappear, because it's a very dangerous thing to be on a jury when the people who are guilty are the military. So that has been something that's been with the Lutheran Church through this time, too. In 1985, two church workers were picked up, one who worked with youth and one who worked with agricultural programs, cooperatives. They were also held in prison. One is now in exile and one is back working with the church. And in 1986, there were at least 18 human rights violations that affected members of the Lutheran community, including the rape of a 14-year-old girl and a couple of disappearances and people being held in custody. And in June of last year, on television, somebody from the Lutheran community apparently got up and denounced Bishop Gomez as being a communist and as providing aid to the guerrillas, as well as the head of Socorro Luterano again. And you have to understand that in this kind of a situation, when somebody goes on television and denounces somebody, it's sort of like the last minute warning, you're going to be picked up and taken away. It's not the sort of thing like everybody just says whatever's on their mind. And everybody was very worried about Bishop Gomez and the church situation there. And I shared earlier with somebody that we were on our way here up to Holden when this happened, when the word came through. And so we had this big letter-writing campaign at Holden last June, in writing to the U.S. Embassy and to the Salvadoran government, saying that as Lutherans we were concerned about these people, and we knew that they were not guilty of what they were being accused of, and we were very concerned for their safety and wanted to know that that they wanted them to know that. And nothing happened after that. They weren't picked up, which is very unusual for that kind of situation. And later on, we heard from the United States Embassy that they had never received that much mail on anything ever that had happened in El Salvador in the entire time they had been there. And they were quite impacted by that. Mm-hmm. U.S. Embassy. Yeah, you have to understand the U.S. Embassy has a lot of power in El Salvador. When we were there, we were just shocked. You know, you read the paper every day and you expect to find out, well, what's the president say today and what is the Legislative Assembly doing today? And Legislative Assembly was doing nothing. They were on strike because they didn't like what the president had said, so nothing was happening there. There were a couple articles about the president saying what an awful person he was. They just, you know, really dragged him through the mud. And then so many times when we looked in the paper, the headlines were about Ambassador Kaur, the U.S. ambassador. What Ambassador Kaur said today. I said, what is our ambassador doing in the headlines? I mean, as if that's the most important event that's happening in El Salvador. But there's something about that that says where the power is in that situation. And so, yes, the U.S. Embassy was an important place to write. And it had an effect. And so I think it's important for people to know that. You may have been asked to write letters before for other things, and you say, another letter, what's my letter going to do? But it is true that letters are counted, and they are read, and they know there are people behind those letters that care. And so that's important to do. And so part of our connection with the Lutheran Church is that sort of support for them. That's sort of how the whole picture fits together. There's just one other thing I want to say about the war, and then also share with you something that's happening both in the Lutheran Church and nationally about that. What, there's different tactics in war. I'm not really well-versed in military maneuvers, but there's one that's going on in El Salvador that I sort of understand what they're trying to do. They call it depopulation. And the idea is, according to what the Salvadoran military has said, is because the guerrillas are out fighting in the jungles and in the forests, somebody's obviously feeding them. They're obviously being kept alive somehow, and it must be the people who live there that are doing that. Therefore, if we want to win this war, we need to get rid of their source of supply. So they talked about the idea of taking the water away from the fish. That's sort of the visual image they have of depopulation. And they've moved people from the countryside out of their homes. And they've done it in a not very nice way, in that they bombed their homes. They have literally forced them out. There's been a lot of death involved and a lot of human rights violations in that. And they basically said to the people, you cannot live here anymore because we are fighting here. And so that's created this great abundant number of displaced people who are now in refugee camps, who have to be fed by other people, who aren't able to support themselves. There's been illness, and of course you can imagine too some of the emotional trauma of people just being taken away from their homes and live in an artificial community where they have nothing to do. I mean, no way to really maintain their own dignity of life. And after 7 years, some people finally began to say, we've had enough. And they said, if we're going to die, which it looks like this war will go on forever, and we might die anyway, we might as well die in our homes. We'd rather go back and farm our land and at least be able to live and reunite with our families. So there was sort of this massive popular movement to go back to their homes. And they sort of went back with the idea and telling the military, no, you cannot fight here anymore because we're farming. And that's sort of their philosophy, and it worked so far in a very unusual way. They've gone back, there have been at least four or five big repopulations, groups of families that have gone back to places where they lived before. They've gone and rebuilt their bombed out buildings. They've gone to their crops that have been lying there and have a lot of holes in them from bombs, and they've replanted their crops. They have reunited with families. There have been times when people have gone back to their villages to live, and they've been reunited, a mother with her daughter she hadn't seen for 5 years since she was moved out of that place, and the daughter lived in a neighboring town and wasn't displaced, but the mother was, and this is the first chance she'd been back to her home, and so families were reunited, and there are just some really incredible personal stories. And I think what was motivated was their faith, and they've been supported also by an international community, religious and otherwise, in this particular situation. I think the first major repopulation movement of people was in January of last year, where they went to a town called Tenancingo. There were 58 families, and about 1,000 joined them later on. And the Archbishop helped in the negotiations with the military and the opposition to make sure they could get there. And now they have a sign at the entrance of their rebuilt town that says, Tenancingo, Seed of Peace. And I think that's part of the image of what people see this movement as being. It's almost a real naive sort of idea, like, you know, we can stop the fighting if we just go back and take up life, and yet it works, you know. We're much too sophisticated for our own good. Last May, there was a National Committee for Repopulation formed. They had a big convention, and a committee was formed. And since then, they've planned three other repopulations. One went to San Jose de las Flores, a town called San Jose. There were 26 families that went on that one. 15 people were accompanying from international community. And later on, there were about 250 to 500 people who, they come just from neighboring villages. They sort of appear after the people get there. And they had some problems because food was intercepted by the military and they weren't able to get everything they needed. So there were some negotiations involved in that. And actually, I think what I'll do is I have some pictures of a couple of these places, and I'll just start passing these around. And you won't know what all of them are right now, but they're marked. And they were there recently. But one of the important things they discovered in the repopulation is that it was necessary to have people to protect them as they moved back. because it would be really easy for the military to wipe them out or accidents to happen and nobody to know what happened to them. So there have always been a group, a delegation of people from other countries, a lot from the United States, mostly from religious communities, from churches, who've accompanied them, and they've been a presence because nobody wants to kill foreigners because it can get them into deep trouble. And so they have served as sort of a support and also a reminder to the government that these people do not stand alone. It's not just their movement, but they have the support of other religious communities. There have been some problems after San Jose de las Flores, there was a repopulation in El Barrio, and that's one of the ones that I have there on the pictures, where 132 families went back, and about 500 people, and there were 19 foreigners who were accompanying them, largely from the United States. And the day after they got there, in the middle of the mass, some of the military came and took the foreigners away and deported them to Guatemala. It was sort of a shock to them. They didn't expect this. And the people were very upset because they were afraid what would happen to them. One woman tried to give her child to one of the foreigners because she was so afraid that something was going to happen. And that farming co-op had suffered a lot during those early days in trying to establish some sort of secure situation. But when we visited them, they were doing very well. They're very near a military checkpoint. But also we have, I don't know if any of you know Pastor Phil Anderson from ALC. He is the Lutheran World Federation representative, and they have some connections with El Barrio and have provided some support for them, and he visits them. But there are some interesting pictures there of, for instance, there are little bomb shelters, which are holes in the ground, which they would hide in whenever the bombs came over. And it was interesting, when they came back, they rebuilt their houses, they planted their fields, and then they showed us these little bomb shelters. And the one thing they hadn't done is that they hadn't filled them in. They're not quite sure that they're not going to be needed again. So they sort of left there as a reminder, but also as a possible necessity. And they had a little cemetery there, one of the last bombings before they moved out, where 25 people were killed as a reminder of that time. There was another repopulation 2 months later in August of last year to San Carlos Lempa, and that one did not go so well. The people were taken away, and the military had kept them in a barracks for a long time, and a couple of people involved in it were captured, and it's a little bit demoralizing for the movement. But in January of this year, another repopulation happened, and this one was a great interest to us in a special way because it was the community in Fe y Esperanza, the refugee community, the Lutherans, were running, where 90 families from that community went to a new place to live. And it was not called exactly a repopulation. They didn't go back to where they lived before necessarily, but they were going to some land that had been rented for them. It was sort of a relocation. And after 5 years of living in a refugee camp, they were extremely excited to be able to have land where they'd be able to farm again. And we went down to visit that one also. Bishop Gomez goes down there every week. He hikes down. You have to understand this place is in a little valley. It's beautiful. There are a lot of trees and there's land, but there's no road, and there's a path that goes sort of straight down. Takes you only, half hour to get down. And it took us about an hour to get back up with a lot of huffing and puffing. But it's in that kind of a context that the people have been building houses all together. They've gathered and together they build the houses. And after they're built, the people find out who's going to live in them. They have it organized so that it's not an individualistic concern, but one in which all people participate. And they're building up a community that hasn't existed there before. There are a number of problems with it. They've had problems with their water supply that they need, and they have problems with, well, everything. They need education. They need to build up all those things that they had before in Fe y Esperanza and now are still in the process of developing. But there's an incredible sense of hope there, and people were sort of elated at the fact that they were no longer in this sort of dry refugee camp where life was just not like they remembered it, and they were not able to do some of their own subsistence in a meaningful way. So there are some pictures there of Panchami Lama. Every week, Bishop Gomez goes down there and holds a service, and the people gather. There's some wonderful musicians. I think all the musicians there must be over 70. They were playing these big bass and the guitars, and there's an incredible amount of excitement in the people and appreciation for that participation of the church. And that's sort of where the repopulations have stopped at the moment. There's another major one planned for the fall, and it's from a refugee camp in Honduras called Mesa Grande. And they're hoping to repopulate 1,000 families to 5 different parts of El Salvador. And it's going to be a major, major effort with a lot of things that could happen in the process. But it's an exciting thing. In the midst of war, I think it's good to have some stories of hope, even though they are themselves fraught with still a lot of danger. And who knows how long this movement will be allowed to continue. I mean, it's working now, but if it becomes too uncomfortable for the government, they could also do a lot to stop it. But right now, the church is ensuring that it's able to happen and as safely as possible. And so that's part of what they're doing. Oh, yes. Very. You know how they found where the water was? They walked around. There's this guy that walked around at night with this instrument. And first of all, he just walked down this. That was in San Jorge in the eastern part of El Salvador. And at nighttime, above the ground where there's water, the air is warmer. And so you walk around at night when it's cold until you find some warm air. And then you start investigating, and you think that maybe that's where the water is. They've been working on that well for, 3 months? They were going down 150 feet. And they were getting very excited the day we were there because they'd found rocks, and the rocks were a little bit wet, so they think there may be water below them, not far. But that one person is the one who goes down every day, and they pull up buckets of whatever. That's a Lutheran community in San Jorge where they have a bakery, they have a school, they have a clinic, and they're working on the well, and they have a farming co-op too. So many of the Lutheran parishes there are very diversified. They see their ministry definitely not as just preaching on a Sunday or running a Sunday school, but they really have the concern for the care of the people, including, for instance, one of the major issues in El Salvador right now is forced conscription by the military. Military will come along, and if they see anybody over age 14 is likely to be picked up, and they'll just take the youth away, or they'll stop buses and pull off anybody who looks like a likely candidate and take them away. And if you retrieve your son within 24 hours, you can take him home. If you don't, I mean, then they're considered drafted. So a lot of times the pastor of this community, San Jorge, was telling the times when he'd followed the military truck as they were taking away youth from his town and, you know, just stuck with them all the way and tried to get them free so that they would not have to be forced into military service. But, you know, that's part of his ministry is it's really... Yes, he was. He got him back. But they went through a lot before he got him back. He described a lot of the process of making them go through some of the physical exercises and a lot of the putting down of them and the, you know, making them sort of, I call it torture. I mean, it's a different kind of torture psychologically, though. Just really... Mm-hmm. In El Salvador? No, we were just traveling on our own. We had friends that were working there, and we knew people in the church there, so we had those contacts. And basically, we just sort of lived with the people in the community there for the month we were there. We traveled with Phil Anderson when he went out visiting the different projects that LWF does. And another friend of ours, Pastor Margaret Suter, is doing work there with the women, and so we followed her around too and some of that work and experienced what they were doing. So we had that. Nobody ever feels free in El Salvador. There's always a sense that somebody is watching you. One of the symbols of that are these Cherokee trucks with the polarized windows. You know, you can't see in, but you know those in can see out. They're very much a symbol of death squads and associated with disappearances. And so whenever you see those, or people planted on corners watching the church, which they do sometimes, it just creates this whole sense of, we're never safe in that sense. We also needed permission to go to the repopulation in El Barrio. The military will only allow certain people to go there. You can't just go if you want. You need to be let in by that. But Sarah, you had a question or a comment?
Yeah.
getting worse. When we were there, they had the FMLN had their first really successful strike against a military target in El Paraíso. It was just incredibly well organized and just totally threw the military for a loop, and they realized how vulnerable they were, because this particular strike on the military base could never have happened if they hadn't had people inside who were cooperating. And that's where one of the real weaknesses is of the military, is because when you forcibly conscript people, they're not always on your side. You may get them in the military, but it doesn't mean they're supportive and that they may not take an opportunity to find another way out. So there's a lot, and also shortly after that, there was another attack in the northern part of in San Francisco Gotera. And in fact, another day when we were there, we were driving down a street, and we found out that in broad daylight at noon, what was it, two armed people had stopped a military car and taken away the two people in it, or shot the people who were in it, and left, and nobody saw anything, you know. It's that kind of really daring things that are happening, and the more that that happens and succeeds, and the more that the people in the repopulations, you know, gain power and support too, I think the military is obviously going to get more uptight and more repressive, but. You never know, individuals always operate on a variety of motives. But I think basically the philosophy behind the accompanying, which it's called, is based on some biblical principles too, of being in solidarity with people. And, you know, it's kind of ironic that we've talked about the sanctuary movement so much in the past, people coming to this country because they're displaced and what it means to receive them. And now there have been a call from the Salvadorans to say, please come and accompany us. So in that sense, I think there's a clear asking us to do that by the Salvadoran people. And it has been proven to be safer for them. Bishop Gomez also supports the idea of accompaniment. He himself does a lot of accompanying. I mean, he really has an image in all of El Salvador, even among Roman Catholics, as being a bishop who walks with the people. When he was consecrated bishop, I think of our New Lutheran Church. You know where the bishops are going to be installed in our church? Was it in Chicago? It's in an opera hall, and in New York, it's in some cathedral. Bishop Gomez decided for his consecration, and it was in his invitations, he was going to be consecrated in the refugee camp, and he said he wanted that to be a symbol of his ministry and of the church's ministry. That's where they needed to be. And that symbol has really permeated other religious communities. So he's really been strong on that. He wants people, for instance, to live in Panchimilama internationals because he knows that they will help ensure the safety of the people there. I'm sure he's more pleased with some than others. We all come in a variety of forms and with various degrees of sensitivities. But basically, those people who are sensitive, he has used well. I accompanied somebody to the Red Cross, also to a military base, a man who was looking for his son who'd been picked up by soldiers. This is the second day I was there. I thought, what am I doing in this military base? But it was just incredible. He went in there and he talked to the commander. He said, my son was picked up on the road when he was working in the fields by these military people, and I want to know where he is, which is a very brave thing for a Salvadoran to do, to go into this military base. But Bishop Gomez had sent a letter with us, and he wanted to make sure that it was as safe as possible for him. So I and another person went with him to make sure that he also came out. And this man was just very insistent. But again, Bishop Gomez uses people to make sure that those things can happen, and nobody goes out on a limb all by themselves.
Okay.
Why not? I should just say, too, in closing, that it's one of the things that we're doing right now in LUCOLA, Lutheran Coalition in Latin America, is trying to organize ourselves, especially as groups who are involved in Latin American issues, and also some individuals. And one of the projects that was suggested that would be really a worthwhile one to do this year would be to raise some funds for Panchimilama, because they are renting the land they're on, and they don't have enough to do all the farming they need to subsist. And so we're gathering together information now and sending out this coming month a request to groups to say, if you'd like to support the work in this way, this would be a good thing to do. We checked it out with Bishop Gomez if that's something that he would like, and he said that would be very helpful. The people in Panchimilama are forming a cooperative, and they do need more stability. So we had thought one good positive thing that can be done is also for Lutherans together to gather and to support this. We've also encouraged people to support a campaign that's going on in Washington right now, out of Washington, for the Coalition A New Foreign Policy, which is promoting a campaign of inquiry. And for those of you who are tired of just writing letters to your senator saying I'm concerned, this is a variation on that. It gives you some background data on El Salvador in different areas, and it gives you questions to ask your congresspeople. And you ask your congressperson, like, I want to know about this, and I want to know about that. And what it does is it forces them to do some homework and to respond to you with some answers. And I thought that was a marvelous idea. I've always believed in education. But it puts the burden on them also to educate themselves, and not just to say, oh, somebody else is concerned, and to shelve you, but to say, oh, this person wants an answer from me. What do I know about this? And they may know nothing. So we've been encouraging people to get involved in that. And Lutherans especially have some concerns that our congresspeople may not know we have, and that we need to say, hey, we have people there, and we're concerned about. Do you know about them? Do you know what's happening to our bishop? So that they can respond also and know that their constituency is informed and expects them to be informed too.